Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Pakistani authorities today announced the capture on July 25th of two South African men who were allegedly in Pakistan plotting attacks on their own country. Pakistan claims to have arrested at least six al-Qaeda suspects in recent weeks, including the two disclosed in the weekend's terror alerts. But while Pakistan claims to be cracking down on al-Qaeda, officials in Afghanistan complain their neighbor is harboring and training Islamic militant members of the Taliban. To prove it, they've allowed journalists, including New York Times correspondent Carlotta Gall, to interview a 17-year-old prisoner. Carlotta Gall joins us on the line now from Kabul. Carlotta, who is this prisoner?
He's a young 17-year-old. His name is Mohammed Sahail. He's from Karachi, the port city of Pakistan, and he's a Pakistani. And he said, he told me in an interview recently that he was recruited in his local mosque in Karachi and sent to a training camp in Pakistan, north of Islamabad, where he was trained for a month. And he joined a Pakistani militant group called Jamiatul Ansar, which is the new name for a banned group that was banned shortly after the 9/11. President Musharraf banned it in January 2002. So it sort of morphed and got a new name, but it shows it's still active because he was caught with a membership card on him by Afghan officials.
Of course, Pakistani officials say that they've dismantled these training camps, that they don't allow them. What are Afghan officials saying?
Well, they don't know, but they say we're capturing these people, and it must be happening, because how else would these people be coming? The Taliban, Afghan Taliban militants, tend to be trained or recruited in madrasas near the border, but this guy is completely different. He was recruited in a Pakistani city and sent to a training camp run by a Pakistani militant group. And then got orders to go into to Afghanistan to fight Americans. And he came in with several others who obviously are still at large.
Give us some background on this. Why would Pakistan give, as some are saying, even tacit approval to these camps? Why would it be in Pakistan's interest to let one of these camps keep functioning?
Well, there's a bit of a debate on that. Of course, they deny that they're allowing this to happen. But I think when you talk to Pakistani analysts and journalists and some officials, they point out that al-Qaeda is the real priority and these guys are not the priority. They're not so important. You can then uncover more of a feeling that there is a Pakistani policy of having a controlling influence in Afghanistan for their own protection. It's always been called strategic depth, which is something that they feel they need in case of a war with India, which is their great rival, how to have a sort of buffer place where they can retreat to or at least have as a bulwark behind them if there is a war. And that they see as Afghanistan, so they always want Afghanistan to be favorable to them and possibly even controlled by them.
Well, what does this new information, if true, mean for Pakistan-U.S. relations and for the war on terror, which is presumably al-Qaeda, not as much the Taliban?
Well, it's interesting because the official relationship is one of high praise from the American State Department and administration for Pakistan in the fight against terror, particularly against al-Qaeda. But there is also constant pushing, especially from officials and military in Afghanistan. U.S. military especially are seeing on the ground the problem of the insurgency from across the border. So it's a bit of a dual approach that the U.S. is taking. And I think it's not wholly successful in that Pakistan has been able to get away with fueling the insurgency while they cooperate on the bigger picture of al-Qaeda.
Carlotta Gall, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Carlotta is correspondent for the New York Times. She spoke to us from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Now that the 9/11 Commission has issued its report, which included a recommendation for a National Counterterrorism Center and a new National Intelligence Director, it's up to Congress to shake up Washington's vast spy bureaucracy. What that might mean exactly is being aired again today on Capitol Hill. At a hearing this morning, Republican Congressman Sherwood Bollard of New York expressed his frustration at the pressure lawmakers feel to reform the intelligence system quickly.
People say, we've got all the answers to all the questions now. Let's go forward instantly. Reconvene Congress tomorrow, pass it, and our problems are solved. That's not the way it works.
Bollard says 15 separate congressional committees will examine how to improve intelligence collection and analysis, which offers some hint of how complex a process it is and how long all this might take. Joining us on the line are Ruel Mark Garrett, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington and a former CIA Middle East specialist. Hello, Ruel.
Hello.
And Juliette Kayyem, a senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and a member of a previous National Commission on Terrorism. Hello, Juliette.
Hello.
Juliette, I want to start with you. It's been almost 3 years now since 9/11. Should Congress act quickly? Have we just been lucky that nothing else has happened since then?
Well, it's probably a combination of luck and a lot of stuff that's going on both abroad and here to try to thwart the next terrorist attack. You know, it's sort of, it's water under the bridge at this stage. 3 years have passed. It seems unforgivable, both looking at the president in my mind and also Congress, that nothing has been done and that it took waiting for the 911 commission for there to be any sort of political heat to get people to focus on this specific intelligence failure problem. I'm not quite sympathetic to Congress saying we can't be rushed. I mean, it has been 3 years. On the other hand, of course, there should be hearings. We should figure out whether the 911 Commission had it right and where to go from here. But, it seems a little bit too late to be arguing that Congress has been under tremendous pressure to do this.
Well, leaving the timing aside, Ruel, do you think the 9/11 Commission did make the right recommendations as to how to go about reforming intelligence?
Rarely. I mean, I think the report's a pretty weak report, given the time, money, and manpower spent on it. I think it's actually a pretty bad report. I think it fails. It fails in several areas, but we'll just look at two. I think vis-a-vis the primary problems that we have dealing with al-Qaeda and Islamic extremism, I don't think it does a very good job operationally. It doesn't really touch upon the problems at all of the clandestine service and the way it functions overseas. And I think on the issue of intelligence sharing and analysis, its recommendations are wrong. Much of the problem we had with compartmentation has actually been solved. It's one of the easier things to do. It's primarily a process of getting people co-located. It's getting a slug line right. That is the type of little initials that go into the optical readers on different types of cables that allow them to go to different offices so everybody gets to see them. These things have largely been solved and they're not hard to deal with. Also, I think the report completely skipped, for perhaps understandable political reasons, the larger issue of the failure of political will for several years during the Clinton administration and 8 months during the Bush administration on how to deal with al-Qaeda and catastrophic terrorism.
Well, I want to ask each of you to tell us more about some of the potential pitfalls. But first, here's what John Hamry, who served as Deputy Defense Director under President Clinton, had to say this morning about the inherent conflict between the Director of Central Intelligence and a potential new Director of National Intelligence.
The DCI was powerful because he had the enormous talent base of the CIA underneath him. If you now split that off, you're going to have a smaller personality in charge of the CIA, but that's not going to be the base that undergirds the DNI. This is why I say we're going to get two weaker actors out of this if we're not careful.
And obviously we have to learn some new acronyms too here, Juliette. But is this mostly redrawing some organizational charts, or are we talking about real change here?
Well, I do think the point that almost across the board people think believe is maybe a smart move is trying to separate the daily management of the CIA with someone who would have more national intelligence, more oversight over the entire government structure, that job in one person has been too difficult and not too successful. My personal feeling, and maybe, you know, other people would agree, is that there's been tremendous focus by the 911 Commission on sort of changing sort of where these intelligence boxes are on the chart, and almost no focus on the sort of content of the intelligence that we're gathering, as if in some way having someone responsible is going to change whether, in fact, we knew what was going on with al-Qaeda before, whether we did have the human assets that were telling us stuff, whether in light of Iraq, why didn't we have, as the Senate Intelligence Report said, why didn't we have a single human asset in Iraq? I mean, it's not like Iraq was Burma. I mean, Iraq had Air France flights going back and forth every day. Unless we really focus on that, all this chart changing seems to me to be not so important. My second point is this. I think a lot of the 911 recommendation reports are in some way, without saying so, quite critical of the National Security Advisor under this administration. Because I thought, and I think a lot of people within the National Security Agency thought, that that would in fact have been her role, the National Security Advisor's role, that you take the intelligence you're getting from all sorts of different folks and you figure out what, in fact, we should be focusing on. And it seems to me that if you had a National Security Advisor who, in fact, was doing that, maybe we wouldn't be coming up with all sort of permutations that don't seem to make much sense unless you actually have someone close to the president's ear who's saying, as a political matter, we've got to start paying attention to this.
Ruel, I want to also ask you about another aspect of this, which is some concerns raised by the ACLU that having one person in charge of both domestic and foreign intelligence gathering just puts too much power in one person's hands. I wonder if you agree with that.
It's a possible problem. I mean, it really depends on what the Federal Bureau of Investigation turns into. And the 9/11 report sort of is vague there. If it turns into the domestic equivalent of the CIA, and one can make an argument for that on operational grounds, that if you're hunting for the Islamic terrorist target in the United States isn't going to be easy to some extent from an intelligence perspective. You have to assume people are guilty. That's the only chance you have of trying to actually find the guilty parties in your daily work and using sort of technical assets and bugging people, et cetera. That you do certainly, if we move in that direction and we develop a domestic intelligence service, having an individual who will have control of that, also in control of foreign intelligence, I suppose you run the risk of giving one man too much power.
Ruel, I have to stop you there, and thank you so much, Ruel and Juliet both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Juliet Kayyem is a senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Ruel Mark Garrick is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Just 9 days to go until the 28th Olympiad in Athens, Greece. Considered the pinnacle of sportsmanship and international goodwill, the 2,500-year-old Olympic Games is the world's oldest sporting event, with an opening ceremony that serves as a reminder of an ancient and honorable competition that's been sullied by modernity, professional sports, drugs, politics. Well, not so fast. Apparently, the original Olympics Games contained as much gore as glory, as much violence as victory. Tony Perrottet's new book, The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games, provides the inside scoop behind the two millennium-year-old games, and it's not always a pretty picture. He joins us on the line from New York. And, Tony, to your title first, The Naked Olympics. They were, weren't they?
Yes, they performed in the buff. It was a tradition that was very much at the basis of Greek culture, and it mystified the Persians and the Romans and all the other ancient societies. They thought it promoted degeneracy, and in fact, by our lights, it did, because pederasty was a major part of Greek athletic culture.
Pederasty.
Yes. Older men became mentors to prepubescent boys, and this was encouraged and very much a part of the gymnasium life. And in fact, gymnasiums were prime pick-up spots for the Greek guys.
Well, and there was also a lot of heterosexual sexual activity going on. The women had a separate ceremony. They performed in, as you write, a short tunic with the right breast exposed. But you write, many fathers brought their daughters there to find a mate.
Yes, it was a perfect opportunity, really, to find a husband amongst the Olympic champions who were actually parading around naked, oiled down like prize studs. The other heterosexual activity, of course, was the vast number of prostitutes that would converge on the Olympic Games. They were set up these booths that were nicknamed sex factories, and the women apparently could make as much in 5 days at the Olympic Games as they could in a year and the rest of the time.
All of this nudity and sexuality must have really added to the fray when a war broke out in 364 BC.
What happened was that the usual organizers lost control of the games in a very complicated political sort of mess. And to take revenge, they decided to actually attack the Olympic Games in the middle of a wrestling match. So we have an army actually penetrating the sacred grove and a fight starting, you know, quite a dramatic brawl. And the spectators apparently just took it in their stride. They turned away from watching the wrestling match and started applauding the opposing sides and of the armies as if it was some sports match going on.
Well, in fact, there was one event that would look like that anyway. I was fascinated by the event, the Pancration.
Pancration. I mean, that was the closest one to the martial origin of wrestling and boxing, and the Pancration was this all-in brawl where basically everything was allowed except eye gouging. As you can imagine, if this is done in the nude, it can be quite a traumatic event for some of the athletes. The closest thing we have to it today is probably Thai kickboxing, because they would go in, they would be lashing with their legs, and then they would go down on the ground groveling around trying to strangle one another.
Well, it would be slightly different from kickboxing in that in kickboxing you're not allowed to tear out your opponent's intestines.
There are some rules that have been added in for a more civilized time, but as well as breaking of fingers and bones. So there was one guy who was nicknamed Mr. Digits because that was his way of getting people to give up, with snapping one finger after another until the person surrendered.
Well, Tony, we forget that the Olympics was uninterrupted for 1,200 years, and then it was stopped for several years. It was reinstituted in the late 1800s in the way we know it now. What happened? Did someone decide to say, we're going to make it more civilized?
The revival of athletics came about with the English Victorian scholars who were fascinated by ancient Greek culture. So they had this very sentimental, romantic idea, which was, you know, permeated with this gentlemanly, chivalric code that was enforced in like Eton and Cambridge and Oxford. So that's why we have this image of golden-haired young men and women in tunics, you know, strumming the lyre at, you know, the ancient Greek Olympic Games, where in fact it was a much more raunchy and human event. You have like 40,000 people converging on this one spot. You have the athletes who took part in the boxing of the Pancration certainly didn't match the Apollonic ideal of the handsome, buffed athlete. Their faces were pummeled. There was one boxer who became famous for not giving his opponent the satisfaction of knocking out all his teeth. He swallowed them. There's all these extraordinary images that we have that I think would mystify the ancient Greeks. The whole idea that, for example, corruption is a modern invention, that it makes no sense at all. Human nature hasn't changed. You know, Eupolis of Thessaly was the first of the Greeks at the Olympic Games to be caught as a boxer trying to bribe his opponents to throw their matches against him, and he was fined heavily. The whole idea that professionalism is a modern invention is a bizarre Victorian conception. The ancient Greeks actually wouldn't have distinguished between amateur and professional. They thought money was a very good thing. In fact, they didn't even have a word for amateur. The closest thing was idiotes, which meant an unskilled person or an ignoramus. Even the idea of steroids, I mean, they didn't have steroids in antiquity, but they did have performance-enhancing magic, and we found spells to improve speed and the strength of athletes, and curses were actually written out on lead scrolls and buried in the cemeteries that have been found in Athens. So the whole idea that of this sort of pure, sanctified event is very much a modern invention.
I love that you write that contestants were required to swear an oath on a slice of boar's meat that they hadn't used magic.
That was really their opening ceremonies, and it was aimed at corruption and against this, you know, know, this is the magic that actually permeated ancient Greek society. There was very much a concern that people would use devious methods. Spectators as well would place spells on athletes that they either favored or didn't like. And this was especially common in the chariot race, because gambling, of course, was a big feature of the chariot race. The Greeks loved to gamble about anything. So just in general, I think the whole idea of the ancient Greek games is this very romantic idea of the past is somewhat stilted. Even the idea that they were very democratic is sort of it's a very limited idea of democracy that the ancient Greeks had. For example, you had to compete in the ancient Greek games, you had to be male for a start. Women weren't allowed to compete, and married women weren't even allowed in the stadium as spectators. You had to be a free citizen, which left out a huge amount of the Greek society, which actually existed basically on this slave labor, and you had to be Greek. Barbarians weren't allowed to compete. In a sense, to us, I think the ancient Greek games would be very mystifying. They would mystify us as much as if an ancient Greek came now to the modern games.
Well, Tony Perrottet, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And let the games begin. Hold on to your intestines. Tony is author of The Naked Olympics. He spoke to us from New York.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, new arrests and new questions about why Pakistan is trying to be so helpful to the Bush administration. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A new technology being pioneered at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory may answer the lingering question, was there one shooter or two on November 22, 1963? After decades of speculation and many investigations into the death of President John F. Kennedy, the answer may lie in a strip of dictaphone tape, the single audio recording made of the president's death. In 1990, the tape arrived at the National Archives, where staff decided its age and overuse had made it too fragile to play again. But now, new technology could mean the sounds on the tape might be heard again. Researchers at the Berkeley Laboratory hope to use digital optical cameras to duplicate the sound of gunshots and provide, at long last, a definitive answer as to whether there were three or four shots fired. Archivist Les Waffen is in charge of the project, and he joins us on the line from the National Archives Building in College Park, Maryland. Les, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Let me ask you first how this recording was made originally.
The recording was made by the Dallas Police Headquarters Communications Department. That is very typical at the time that the police would record their radio transmissions back at headquarters. So they had a system of using dictation belts to create recordings of the transmissions, and they're recorded grooves on the belts.
And when it arrived at the National Archives, was there always the hope that perhaps someday these sounds could be duplicated?
Yes. When we first looked at it, technically people said it's in such a condition after being played and used for all these years and for all the investigations that to try and play it mechanically again by putting a stylus in the groove would do further damage and maybe destroy what we consider to be a historical artifact. There's a lot of copies of tapes of this belt that have been done over the years, but none of it has been authenticated, and many are copies of copies of copies. So when people have come to us over the years and said, well, we'd like to have a copy of the Dictabelt, we've had to say to them, well, we don't have a true and faithful reproduction, and we're going to try and do one as soon as we feel it's possible.
And when that day comes, Les, do you think the tape will provide absolute evidence of how many shots were fired?
We will provide what we call a digital map of the sound patterns that are captured on here, and we will make that available to researchers who can reach their own conclusions.
And is this technology available today, or is this simply the start of a process which may take a while?
Well, it's proven, it's been done, and it's beginning to be developed by these scientists, and they've demonstrated it on an Edison cylinder. They demonstrated it on older 78 RPM disc recordings. So the same process can be done to map the grooves of the Dictabelt. It's just that they haven't experimented with Dictabelts yet. The technique should be able to reproduce what was put onto that Dictabelt in 1963. Now there's going to be a lot of extraneous material in there from the deterioration, from the mending tape, from cracks in the belt, and other defects. And hopefully the process that's going to be used will be able to create a digital bitmap of the sound waves, and then someone can take forensic audio techniques and noise suppression techniques and try and peel away the noise and get down to the sound level and see what they come up with.
Les, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Les Woffen is an archivist with the National Archives. He joined us from College Park, Maryland.
It's every diver's nightmare. You're at sea, exploring exotic depths, and when you surface, the boat has left without you. That's the plot of the new film, Open Water. Described as Jaws meets the Blair Witch Project, it was inspired by the real-life story of Eileen and Tom Lonergan, an American couple left behind by their charter boat off the coast of Australia in 1998. The Lonergan story was front-page news for a year down under. It struck fear in the heart of the dive industry, and now the film is doing the same thing. Tom Ingram is Executive Director of the Diving Equipment and Marketing Association in San Diego, California. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, did you know about the story of this couple before you heard about the film?
Sure, yeah. We heard about it when it occurred back in the late 90s.
Well, you know, a lot of people are hearing about it now for the first time. How common is this?
It's very uncommon, and it's one of the reasons why we really don't even have, you know, a large number of statistics about things like this.
Well, but what did happen? We know that, you know, this story reverberates still in Australia. What did happen?
You know, the details of it are pretty unknown because these folks disappeared, but evidently there was an instance where we had two folks that got off into the water, and they simply were not picked back up by the boat, and due to a series of unfortunate circumstances on the boat, whether it was incompetent dive masters or just simply making a mistake, which is possible in any sport, I guess, they didn't do a proper head count, and so they didn't notice that these people were gone.
And that is supposed to happen, a head count before the people jump in and a head count when they come back.
Absolutely, and most of the dive operators actually do a roll call.
Well, as you know, the dive industry in Australia is reacting with anger to the fact that this film was even made. Apparently, this really affected the dive industry in Australia when the event happened.
Anytime some accident occurs in any sort of an activity like this, it sort of raises up the eyebrows and makes you wonder what's going on. But the good that comes out of that kind of thing is that it reinforces the training and the efforts that are being made to make sure that people are safe in the water when they do this are carried forward and advanced.
We understand that the Lonergans kept a dive slate, something that they wrote on, and that was found, and in it they wrote about the date and the time and that they'd been abandoned.
As I recall the story, their equipment was found up on the beach sometime later, and it was also discovered that the gentleman had a diary in which he had indicated that he had some sort of a death wish going into this.
Yeah, but I want to ask you about that, because according to reports that we've read, part of that information was part of a really ugly campaign by people in the dive industry to discredit the couple, to make it that they might have killed themselves or done anything but been abandoned.
Yeah, you know what? I couldn't even respond to that. Yeah. I can only tell you really that this is just two people that were left behind by their dive boat, and everything else beyond that is pretty much speculation.
Yeah. Do you worry about the impact of the film on your industry?
Sure. My biggest concern is that the film does not depict diving in a very good light, and it does that almost from beginning to end, really.
And you've been through this before with other movies.
Well, we've, as an industry, have had to deal with such things as Jaws back in the mid-70s, and it had an impact on the diving industry for a short period of time, or people got the impression that everybody's going to get eaten by sharks when they jump in the water. And I've been a shark diver myself and have done those types of trips where we bait sharks in and take photos of them. And I can tell you that if you raise up off the bottom of the ocean, those sharks disappear in a heartbeat.
Now, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Exactly.
Well, Tom, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Tom Ingram of the Diving Equipment Marketing Association. He spoke to us from San Diego, California, about the new film, Open Water.
Still to come, caught in the crossfire, Border Patrol agents, illegal immigrants, and residents living along the U.S.-Mexico border.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Last year, more than 400 people died, many of them in the blistering summer heat, trying to get into the United States illegally from Mexico. Well, now U.S. immigration officials are trying something different to save lives and discourage illegal immigration. Free flights home. Since the program began on July 12th, more than 2,500 illegal immigrants have been flown back into the interior of Mexico, to Guadalajara and Mexico City. Chris Krall is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, based in Mexico City. And Chris, you've been following this program. What's the reaction so far?
Well, it seems to be pretty good. Not everyone is taking advantage of the program. Not all of the illegals caught in the desert are going. Some want to go right back to the border and try to get through again. But the flights have been fairly full. There have been one or two flights a day since July 12th.
Well, now, it's not difficult to get a bus ticket anywhere in Mexico, not expensive either, to get back to the border. So why do you think the immigrants are willing to even do this?
Go home, see the family, rest up a little bit after a probably grueling ordeal through the Arizona desert, and then give it another shot.
What are you hearing from the immigrants that you've spoken to? Are they going to stay put once they get home, or are they going to try again as quickly as possible?
I spoke to several who came back on the first flight, and with just one exception, also they would be trying it again. For economic reasons, the job prospects in Mexico are pretty grim.
Give us a sense of what it's like trying to make it across the desert. I mean, what's the temperature? What are the conditions there?
July and August, it can be 100 to 120 degrees. They apparently have to survive 2 to 3 days of walking through the desert. It's just a grueling ordeal, and it's extremely dangerous. As you said, 420-odd people died last year, more than 150 so far this year. And it's just a real human tragedy for those who try to make it and don't.
So the hope is, at least on the U.S. side, that perhaps having experienced this once, the people who survive but get caught, get sent back home, maybe they'd be unwilling to go through it again?
I think the thinking is that for maybe the first-time crossers who for the first time have experienced that desert, have been detained, have maybe been in shackles, have had to sit in a detention center in Arizona in the heat, treated not all that kindly by the U.S. Border Patrol, maybe the thinking is that these first-time crossers at least will think better of it and not try it again. I think that's a fallacious assumption in most cases, but for whatever reason, the Border Patrol thinks it's worth the cost and effort. These flights cost about $50,000.
When do you think we'll know whether it's been successful or not?
Well, counting illegal immigration is a very inexact science. The people who are best at it essentially take apprehensions and use that as an index. If so many people are caught, then that means so many people have made it through. Of course, that's really inexact.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Krall of the Los Angeles Times joined us on the line from Mexico City. Thank you.
Stay with us. More on the U.S.-Mexico border. That's ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This border is so open, it's a goddamn joke. He stopped along the side of the road at one point and honked his truck horn, a signal commonly used by smugglers' drivers to call out immigrants hiding in the bushes at their designated pickup point. On this night, no one came out. Vance sounded angry and nervous about the future of an area his family had called home for so many years. He had four dogs to deter intruders. "I don't like having to have vicious dogs," he said. "It's like this." He patted a handgun on the truck seat next to him. "It's a hefty situation."
Author Ken Ellingwood, talking about his ride with an Arizona landowner in his new book, Hard Line, Life and Death on the U.S.-Mexico Border. It's estimated that the U.S. Border Patrol makes 1 million arrests a year somewhere along this 2,000-mile border. Thousands more illegal immigrants slip in undetected. U.S. officials say a woman with possible terrorist ties entered the country across the Rio Grande earlier this month. Federal agents are on the lookout for a Middle Eastern man who paid a higher-than-usual smuggling fee to cross the border. And officials say Al-Qaeda plans to cross some of its operatives in the coming months. But largely, illegal crossings are by Mexicans. Some don't make it and end up in paupers' graves, much like the one in Holtville, Arizona, where 133 are buried. Ken Ellingwood writes about them and all the players in the drama on the U.S.-Mexico border in his new book. He's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and covered the U.S.-Mexico border from 1998 to 2002. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Right at the beginning of the book, you use a wonderful metaphor. It's an image of a balloon filled with water to describe the sort of shifting immigration bubble that we're witnessing. Tell us about that.
Well, the idea is that by cracking down on one part of the border to stop illegal immigration, the government is doing the equivalent of stepping on a balloon, that is, forcing the bulge elsewhere in the balloon, diverting the flow of immigrants to another area.
And who hasn't filled up a water balloon and can picture that metaphor? What was the area that now is sort of relieved of the immigration flow, and what is the area that's now, as you put, being blindsided by it?
The area that was the focus of the government's unprecedented enforcement effort back in the mid-1990s was the area around San Diego and Tijuana. When they put into place what is called Operation Gatekeeper in 1994, illegal crossings in that area, as measured by arrests, have plummeted over the years. The result, however, of that action was to push migrants farther to the east, and we're now trying to make those crossings in areas that are much more mountainous or desert lands, much more dangerous areas, in other words, to try to make it across.
More of them are dying.
Many more of them have died of exposure and environmental problems like cold.
And have placed families that live along the border, on at least on the American side, in really peculiar situations. We just heard you talking about the Vance family, and this is a man who's driving around in his pickup, literally afraid to leave his property.
Yes, as the traffic of illegal immigrants moved east, communities that previously had seen some illegal crossings, but not that many, suddenly found themselves in the bullseye. And there were a lot of different reactions by people along the border to this new reality that they suddenly faced. And they pointed out to me as I rode around with them, spent time on their ranches with them, they didn't have anything personally against the border crossers who were making their way onto U.S. soil there. They resented more in their conversations with me the U.S. government policy that sort of placed them in this uncomfortable position.
Yeah, but it's really sort of a not in my backyard or not in my back desert.
Very true.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, if you could, there's so many players in this drama. Can you just tick off the number of people that we might not even think of who are involved in this story?
Well, there are a lot of people that you would really never consider. We would always think, of course, of the Border Patrol agents on one side, the migrants on the other, perhaps the smugglers who are trying to sneak them across. But in the course of traveling along the border and writing about this story and writing this book, I spent time, for example, on an Indian reservation in southern Arizona, a tribe called the Tohono O'odham Nation. Their ancestral lands span the international boundary. And for centuries, they went across back and forth on their own ancestral lands, even before there was a U.S.-Mexico border there. And for decades after there was a U.S.-Mexico border that split their land in two, they would cross through informal gaps in the cow fence without really any concern whatsoever. It was only by the late 1990s when suddenly they found themselves, as did the people in Douglas, in the crosshairs of this new immigration war on the border. They found their lands suddenly difficult to cross. Those tribal members on the Mexican side who carry full tribal membership with the U.S. tribe were getting arrested as they came north through those informal crossings that the tribe had used mm-hmm. for many, many years.
On this program, we've covered the vigilantes, for instance, who have made it their job to arrest these border crossers. But I was also just so touched by the people who went out of their way to help them.
Yeah, there were a number of people, particularly in Arizona, though not limited to Arizona, who began to see the toll on the migrants. Some of these Americans, ordinary folks, just out of what they call a humanitarian impulse, a Christian impulse to help the stranger, to welcome them, took to trying to help the migrants in different ways. One group in Arizona, for example, began placing water stations in the desert in areas that were known to be corridors for crossing. In other cases, there were people who actually helped migrants by sheltering them once they made it across the border, and even helping them get past Border Patrol checkpoints to make their way north into the interior. Mm-hmm. One woman in Bisbee, Arizona, who I do not identify by name in the book to protect her, was regularly housing undocumented immigrants in her hotel and feeding them, getting their strength back up to continue the journey. And then she and friends would put these folks in a car dressed in quote-unquote American-style clothing, and oftentimes after having given them a hairstyle, and kind of making them look like just a family taking a little trip. And they would drive past the Border Patrol checkpoints in Arizona and get them north.
Mm. Well, as you introduce us to all the people involved in these skirmishes along the border, there's, as you know, national debate raging as to what should happen on the border. What do you see, you know, from your research? Do you come to a conclusion about what should happen?
I don't prescribe a solution to the problems that I witness. My job as a journalist, I think, is to bring the reality of the border to the rest of the country. And, you know, the border is a place that everybody seems to have strong opinions about, and very few people actually know anything about or have actually seen it. And what I wanted to do was to make the border a place that was living and real to readers, a place that they could see and smell, and a place where they could see ordinary citizens trying to live a life.
You say not many people have even been to the border. I know how shocking it is to come from the east to the west and drive along and see the picture that you've got on your cover. This looks like it's outside San Diego. And when you drive down through Southern California, there are huge signs on the side of the road, big yellow signs with people running. And when I first saw that, what is that? And what is it?
There are highway signs leading north from the border on the freeway in Southern California near San Diego that show a family at full sprint running across the road, much as you might see a deer caution sign or a moose crossing in northern New England. And they put them up in the early 1990s when so many people were racing across the border on foot.
And getting hit.
Yeah. And getting hit. It to me symbolizes both the life and death stakes of this journey that people are making, and it also tells you just how chaotic it was in the early 1990s in San Diego. But the signs are still there,
and they could be put up in the desert, but with a different, you know, kind of death there. That's the death from the elements.
Exactly.
Ken, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ken Ellingwood's new book is called Hard Line: Life and Death on the U.S.-Mexico Border.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.